Welcome to We The Podcast, the show about how the people outside of the billionaire and millionaire class, you know, most of us, engage the economy. $6, $6, six bones, six clams, whatever you want to call it. It's all someone working full time at the federal minimum wage would have left after paying the average rent for a one bedroom apartment in the United States of America today. You know, you might be able to afford a Big Mac or two after paying your rent, but after paying the light bill and being able to get to and from work might be a little difficult. This week on the podcast, we're talking about the minimum wage. Tens of millions of Americans work full-time for the minimum wage. For many, that's as little as $7.25 an hour. Two-thirds of all people who would benefit from an increase in the minimum wage are women. And they're on average 35 years old, raising families. Many of those workers are primary breadwinners for their household. Many are single parents. It's time to give America a raise. It's time to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour, indexed to the median wage thereafter. And how about a union? This shouldn't be a partisan issue. And as it turns out, it's actually not. Three quarters of Americans, regardless of party, support raising the minimum wage. And almost two thirds support raising it to $15 an hour. 19 states have increased their minimum wage this year. States as different as Arkansas and New York. And last year, Washington, D.C. approved raising the district's minimum wage to, you guessed it, $15 an hour. We'll talk with Brittany Butler, a college graduate and a low-wage worker in Washington, D.C. Kendall Fells, the national organizing director for the Fight for 15, and author and president of SEIU Local 775 in Seattle, David Rolfe. And we'll bring you portions of a press conference where Democratic leadership of the House of Representatives and the Senate announced their support for a $15 minimum wage indexed to the average wage. Brittany Butler is a college graduate from Howard University, and works at a clothing store in Union Station in Washington, D.C. And she's an organizer with Good Jobs Nation, one of the leading organizations in this fight for 15. I talked with her about her story, her life, how she ended up working in a low-wage job, and how she got involved in the fight for 15. So you're a college graduate, right?
Yes, I'm a college graduate.
And you still, you know, have to fight to get your wages elevated. Is that the case?
Absolutely. And I just want to let people out there know that, yes, it's not just an issue for people who are poor. This is an issue across the board, across different economic lines. Yes, I have two college degrees, and I'm struggling to provide for myself and pay off my student loans. You know, I am somebody who isn't looking for a handout. And I think people don't understand that. A lot of people who are working customer service and retail type jobs, they're not some high school kids sitting in their parents' basement, living off their parents, and they're using their paychecks to buy new clothes and sneakers. The average retail and service worker is 30 years old, and they are struggling to make a living. And a lot of the retail workers that work next to me have college degrees. I was somebody who was born at Howard University, struggling college student, not sure what I was going to do after I graduated, and somebody afforded me an opportunity to work with the campaign because I would meet other people who were like-minded and who had similar situations. Like I said, I come from a working class family. I had to take out loans to go to school. Once I finished college, I didn't necessarily have any good job prospects. So I was working part-time doing retail and customer service jobs, and then I started helping out with the campaign. And it was so refreshing to see other people in my position who shared the same passion, who wanted to just make an honest living and wanted to be able to provide for themselves and their family.
Tell me about some of the people you've met. Like, I remember being out there on the picket line with you guys, and I met one guy who didn't speak too much English, but I could tell from his arms that he had suffered a grease spatter. I met some other folks who were, you know, some of them were, you know, hardworking folks. They were like in their 50s and 60s and hadn't seen a raise in 20, 30 years. Tell me about some of the people you work with every day.
Absolutely. No, I definitely can attest to those stories. I talk to different people who work in Union Station with me, and yes, they are a lot older than me, and they're working 40-plus hours a week at some of these fast food places. And yes, and they get mistreated on the job, or sometimes they get hurt on the job, and the manager is like, you can go home and don't get paid for the rest of the day, or you can suck it up. Yeah, it's a terrible thing. You know, they get grease splatters. Sometimes, you know, they're sitting on their feet all day and they're not offered a proper break.
You could argue that that's wage theft. I mean, sometimes they check the break off of your paycheck, but they don't let you have the break.
Absolutely, yes. Yeah, some of that has gone on too. Yeah, we have definitely had cases where we were talking to people who, yes, have in fact suffered wage theft, and there are people now fighting, trying to get those wages back because they weren't put on their paycheck. Absolutely. You know, there are people who have also been sexually assaulted on the job. You know, that goes back to the issue, like you said, with young women working these types of jobs. It is, in a way, dangerous for some people to make a livelihood working in these jobs. They're getting sexually harassed by their boss. Some of the janitors at Union Station, some of the female janitors were going through that issue where, you know, if they weren't giving in to the demands of their male supervisors, they were retaliated against. And, you know, a lot of people aren't aware of these issues. These are the same people coming in early in the morning and staying late at night, Union Station, cleaning the floors, waxing the windows and all this stuff. And, you know, they're being assaulted and they're getting paid low wages. And, you know, when we hear stuff about, oh, we're not going to give away raising the wages, people aren't going to get overtime pay or time and a half, it's ridiculous. People are going through a headache just to make a living.
Brittany's right. It's wrong to treat workers so poorly. And here's the thing. Raising the minimum wage is good for business and the economy. How do we know? Yep, there are plenty of studies and papers on this topic of what happens when you raise the minimum wage. But there's also the real world example. Enter the Emerald City, Seattle, which was also one of the first cities to raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour. To learn about the fight to 15, I talk with David Rolfe, president of SEIU Local 775 in Seattle. And he wrote an awesome book. I recommend it. It's a good read. It's called, What Else? The Fight for 15. And he talked to us about what changed in Seattle.
Things are so much better. Let me tell you, our unemployment rate here is 2.7%.
Pretty good.
Someone sent me a photo the other day of a fast food chain sandwich shop that was advertising starting pay, not of $15, but of $20 an hour. This is still a city where we have haves and have nots. You know, the underlying crisis in the American economy has not gone away. But what has happened is that if you are a low wage worker who works for a living in Seattle, you're no longer living below the poverty line.
Well, some folks would have you believe that if you increase the minimum wage, you're going to drive out small business. What do you say to that?
Well, that's the mythology that the big business often pays their lobbyists and advertising consultants to perpetuate, but you simply can't find an example of it ever having happened since America first instituted a minimum wage in 1937. In fact, you look at all of the myths that they tell you, and none of them turn out to be based in any actual data or experience. Back in my book, I talk about the fact that back in 1913, the head of the American Publishers Lobby predicted that if Congress passed a law restricting children under the age of 16 from working only 8 hours a day, that it would put the department store industry out of business. I'm sorry, the head of the department store lobby predicted that. Later, in the 1930s, the head of the publishers lobby said that America would fall like ancient Rome if we adopted a minimum wage. Well, America has some challenges at the moment, I would say, but it's been a long time since we adopted that first minimum wage in 1937, and the republic still stands.
Let me ask you this. There's another myth out there which says, well, I don't know if it's a myth. I'll let you be the judge of that. It says that if you raise the minimum wage, the retailers will just increase prices, and it'll just be inflation, and the purchasing power that used to be captured by $15 will just go back down to whatever it was in the past because of inflation.
Yeah, that would only be true if labor were the only cost of a business. But they have to pay rent. They have to pay for the utilities, insurance. They have to pay for whatever they're selling, the goods or services, the cost of that. So it's actually only a percentage of the business's costs that are embedded in the cost of labor. And so, yes, do some businesses choose to increase prices? Some do. Some choose to swallow the costs and hope that their volume will go up if their competitors increase prices. But what we can say with certainty is that sandwich shop now paying $20 an hour to entry-level employees, that employee is making more than 100% of what they made 3 years ago. The cost of that sandwich may have gone up by a quarter. So the incremental inflation rate in the price of services is far, far outweighed by the increased spending power for low-wage workers. And as you know, when low-wage workers get a pay increase, what they do is they spend that money in their local community. They buy a sandwich. They replace the broken dryer or the leaky roof. They fill a prescription. They enroll in a course. They do the things that actually provide stimulus to the local economy by creating demand for goods and services. When you give, it's true that if you give a billionaire a tax break, that some of that money gets spent in the local economy. And in general, you get about 40 cents of economic activity for every dollar you give a billionaire. But when you give a low-wage worker a pay increase, you get $2.32 of local economic activity for every dollar of the pay increase, because that money circulates again and again in the local economy.
What about the opposite? Let's just say we buy the arguments of the people who are against a fair wage for Americans. And, we are aware of the Walmart effect, where you have people who work plenty of hours, and yet they are eligible for food stamps, medical assistance, rental assistance. I mean, do we pay one way or another?
Well, of course we do. You know, what we see with so many large employers, Walmart is the most famous one, but we could name a whole lot of others, is that when they underpay their workers, they're asking the rest of us to subsidize their bad business practices. They're asking you, they're asking me, and they're asking the majority of companies that actually do the right thing. So, every time that someone enrolls in Medicaid who's employed by a Fortune 500 company, that's essentially us taking money out of our pockets to pay the wage and benefit costs of a worker that ought to be compensated by this giant global for-profit publicly traded corporation for whom they are helping to create value every day. Now, on the flip side, what happens when that worker also, can't even afford to shop at the store where they're serving sandwiches or selling goods, is that's a long-term drain on the economy. So when you look at the relatively lethargic rates of GDP growth in the United States, even as capital markets and corporate profits have soared, one of the significant causes of that is that if you're in the bottom 90% of income earners, you simply don't have a lot of discretionary income. And that is that actually restrains economic growth for everyone who's not in the business of selling yachts or private planes.
Yeah, fascinating. So, a lot of debate happens here in Congress about what the cause is of slow growth after the 2008 recession. Sounds like what you're saying is the failure to raise the minimum wage and the inability of unions to be able to negotiate for higher wage because their numbers have shrank dramatically since the 70s.
That's exactly right. We've essentially made a decision that was never debated. It was never voted on. But we nevertheless made a decision as a country to walk down a low-wage path and to become a low-wage nation. When I was growing up, we were taught, rightly or wrongly, that America was number one. Well, if you're measuring the size of our middle class vis-a-vis our global competitors today, we're not number one. We're number 27. We have the 27th largest middle class. We used to have the largest. Germany now has the largest. And in Germany, they have something called collective bargaining that sets wages for more than 80% of their workforce.
Well, and I think also workers are on the corporate boards in Germany. Well, is that right?
For German large companies, 50% of their boards are workers. For smaller companies, it's 30%. Last year, I was part of a group of U.S. labor leaders that brought American fast food workers on a tour of Europe, and they were shocked. Starbucks workers from the United States were shocked to hear Starbucks workers in Germany actually sit down and jointly make decisions about the management of the enterprise with managers. And hamburger workers from Chicago and St. Louis were shocked to meet their counterparts in Denmark making $21 an hour under union contracts.
How does America address income inequality unless we either give greater rights to workers to bargain for a wage or we increase the minimum wage legislatively?
You know, I don't think there really isn't a way to address income inequality without one of those two things, unless we want to get into, you know, what some people are calling for now, a universal basic income.
Right,
this was
right.
A debate that we had back in the 60s and 70s. Interestingly, Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and Milton Friedman both believed in some type of universal basic income. But that is a long-term strategy, and it's unlikely to be realized in the short term. So in the near term, as long as Americans are working for a living, I would argue we need a number of things. We need a high minimum wage. We need broad bargaining rights that are not optional bargaining rights. You know, no one ever says that you have to get your neighborhood group to vote to give you the right to free speech, or
right.
Your condominium association to vote to give you the right to register to vote or to carry arms or to have a trial by jury. But somehow Americans have to go through this arduous process to access collective bargaining. That means a minority of workers have access to it. And even though union members make 20% more than non-union members in the same jobs, becoming a union member today is so difficult that only 6-7% of folks in the private sector are lucky enough to have a union. So we need at least two things. We need strong minimum wage laws, and we need to completely reinvent the way we think about worker organizing in this country to provide broadly accessible bargaining rights that apply to whole industries and geographies, not this weak, puny kind of bargaining that's one company, one workplace at a time. That's the system that General MacArthur imposed on occupied Japan in the 1940s. Japan's now in the fourth decade of a recession. General Eisenhower helped Germany revive an older system of regional and sectoral bargaining, and Germany, last time I checked, is kicking our butt economically.
We have to empower workers, and the most powerful tool these workers have is their own voice. But organizing on your own is tough, and that's where Kendall Fells stepped in. He is the organizing director for the Fight for 15, and Kendall, who's, you know, gotten to be a pretty good friend of mine, talked to me about the Fight for 15, how he started, how it started, and how it has spread all over the country and even the world.
Well, you know, back in 2012, I went out. I was sent out to New York because there were a group of fast food workers there who were experiencing, you know, a lot of abuse inside of their stores. They were experiencing wage theft. They were being sexually harassed. They were making minimum wage, which was $7.25 in New York City. And, you know, that was, you know, a worker who had been there 10 years or a worker who had been there 5 years or started today, all making about the same amount of money. They were living in homeless shelters. They were couch surfing, like bouncing around. This is like with their kids. They were sleeping in parks. And, you know, when we brought these workers together, they show burns up and down their arms, and they wanted to do something. And that's when they decided that they wanted that they thought that $15 an hour and the right to form a union without retaliation from their employer so they could have a voice on the job would give them a step up and an opportunity to be able to at least get the necessities in life, food, shelter, and clothing. So when I went out there and I met these workers and pulled together those first meetings, and then that first strike happened November 29th, 2012, every media outlet in the country was there. And, you know, these workers have now sparked a movement that spans 320 cities across the U.S. and 40 countries, and $15 is now as American as apple pie. So I was inspired when I went out to New York because, you know, when you work for companies like McDonald's that make $5 billion in profit and taxpayers are picking up the bill because they don't want to pay their workers a fair wage, it's easy to get inspired, Congressman.
I mean, you mentioned earlier that $15 has become as American as apple pie. But for a while, it was considered, well, not as American as apple pie. Can you talk about how you moved it from basically a kind of an idea that some hopeful, optimistic people came up with to one that really has become mainstream?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's a funny question. When you go back to 2012, around that time, President Obama wasn't even at $9 before the first strike. There were two congressmen, Harkin and Miller, were out on 1010, and I mean, people were laughing at them. And so, you know, these workers, you know, worked for billion-dollar companies in New York City where they were making $7.25 and living in poverty. They had nothing to lose. They decided to walk off the job on November 29th, 2012, going on strike, meaning they walked off the job and, you know, they're in front of their stores with 200, 300 people talking about how their wages are being stolen, how their arms are being burnt at work, how they don't have the right equipment, how they live in homeless shelters, and how McDonald's has more than enough money to pay them a fair wage. And what they said a fair wage was $15, because in New York City they felt like it, maybe if we had $15, you know, they were making $7.25. So this was an ambitious goal, but that maybe if we made $15, we would have just enough to get food, shelter, and clothing. And we know we need a union because we need a voice on the job. That's the way we're going to be able to keep our $15, and that's the way we're going to be able to fix our other issues. This wasn't an MIT calculator. This wasn't an academic that looked at any poll or any statistics and came. These were workers, the ones that were living this, that decided that this would be enough. After that first strike on November 29th, 2012, we started to get emails, Facebook downloads, Twitters of workers from different cities that were fast food workers saying, how can we do something like that in our city? It was everywhere. It was on the news. It was online. It was on the national news, local news. It was a really, really big deal. And so those workers in other cities like Kansas City, Chicago, Detroit, St. Louis, these workers started to do the same thing, organizing, going. What they were doing were going on strike in their cities. They had pastors with them, community leaders with them, community residents. Those people would come out to their rallies the day of their strikes to support them. And the next day, they were being walked back into work by congressmen and by aldermen and council members and mayors and pastors that would call the manager to the front desk and say, this is my friend Keith, and he went on strike to get out of poverty, and he's coming back to work, and we don't expect any nonsense. It was the community support. So as these strikes started to spread throughout the country, you know, we started off in 2012 with New York City. By 2013, we were in about 150 cities, the end of 2014, we're in about 200 cities, and you know, here we are now in 320 cities across the country. What these workers have created is they created a movement in this country based off the facts. Look, 46% of the workers in this country make less than $15 an hour. When these workers went on strike, everyone identified with them. That's why home care workers and child care workers and other workers started to join. And then, you know, Governor Cuomo did the wage board in 2015. 200,000 fast food workers got 15. Then we won 15 in California, the state of New York. And as these workers led, politicians started to follow behind, and companies like Facebook and Aetna and Nationwide Insurance. These companies went to 15 voluntarily because these workers made this an issue, the issue of income inequality in this country. And I think that, you know, as these workers hit the streets and they made noise in their cities, companies, politicians, and everything else in the polls caught up with them.
So, hey, Kendall, a lot of people will say, you know, now, as you said, the workers made 15 the thing. But some of these politicians forget about the anti-union part. How critical is that part, and how serious are the workers about it?
The union part is essential. It's interesting. If you talk to the workers now, they would tell you they're already in a union, because if the definition of unions, workers coming together to create change, then obviously that's what these workers have done, and they've created a union that is national. The fact of the matter is they're telling McDonald's that McDonald's needs to you know, give them the opportunity to actually join a union. The part of the deal here, Congressman, is the process to join a union is so small, and this campaign is so big. This campaign isn't one facility or one city or one state. Literally, that's why we have the National Organizing Committee. That's the glue to keep the campaign together. But without the union, these workers are going to continue to be burned on the job. They're going to continue to have their wages stolen, where they'll have workers come in and start to count drawers and not before they clock in. So you count a drawer for 45 minutes and not getting paid for it. So you're doing that on the front end and the back end of your shift. You do that times 40 hours a week, and you just start to see how this money's racking up, making them replace money that's taken out the register, even though multiple people have been on the register, et cetera. So these workers are going to have to actually have a union, because, look, unions are the reason this country had a middle class. You know, unions are the reason that workers have been able to negotiate pensions and health insurance and wage increases. Otherwise, these companies hoard all the money. And so so I think that the workers are clear that the union part is 15 and a union, not 15 or a union. At the beginning of this campaign, though, the fact of the matter is everybody said that this was crazy and that these workers would never get 15 and they would never get a union. And this was the stupidest idea. 200 workers walked off the job and everyone was saying that they wouldn't get back in and they would all be fired. So these workers have been against all odds. Now people have conceded that these workers have won on 15 here in this country, and now workers are concentrated on getting the union and being part of an organization where they can have a voice and continue to lift people up from the bottom so that people don't have to live in poverty.
I remember being honored to be at the convention in Chicago, and we talked about 15, of course, but we also talked about issues of racial justice. We talked about criminal justice reform. We talked about immigration. We talked about, like, a lot of stuff. It's almost like 15 is, like, the first part of the conversation. It opens up into a bunch of other conversations about equity and inclusion in our country.
So when Mike Brown was murdered in Ferguson, Missouri, the strikes were happening. These workers, this is bigger than a strike. These workers are they have a skill now. They have the skill to go out, agitate their coworkers around the issue and actually get their coworkers to mobilize and be in the streets. When Mike Brown was murdered, the McDonald's that's in Ferguson, that was our McDonald's. We were striking that McDonald's. Every single worker out of there had been coming on a strike for about a year or so. When Mike Brown was murdered, those same workers were the workers that were frontline in Ferguson and the organizers out organizing people in that community, frontline against the police, frontline in the paper, becoming members of BLM. The same thing when Eric Garner was murdered in New York, the same thing in Charleston. These workers, they have a skill. They have a unique skill to agitate people and get them upset enough so that they'll actually do something. And so now they're they have a racial issue. There's a racial component to this campaign. Obviously, most of these workers are black and brown workers. And we have a multicultural movement, but most of these workers are black and brown. You know, over 50% of black workers make less than 15, and over 60% of Latinos.
It really is a movement that empowers black and brown workers. But I was also surprised to see a lot of white workers. I was talking to people from Wisconsin, Tennessee, Kentucky. You know, a lot of times, you know, you don't always see, you know, you don't expect, you know, the white workers to always join in because of our nation's racial past and present. But it's not true. There's actually quite a few white workers part of this movement. Can you speak to that reality?
Absolutely. We have white workers in all of our cities. We have white workers in Raleigh, North Carolina. We have white workers in Kansas City. I mean, we have a multicultural movement. The fact of the matter is the disproportionately black and brown people are affected. But in the same vein, that we have white workers in all of our cities that are dealing with the same problem. When you look at workers in this country without looking at race, almost half the workers in this country make less than $15 an hour. And, you know, over $15 an hour is like $15.50,
$15.25.
So, just a little over. Yeah. You know what I mean? Then that's the cut. So, you know, So it's not, you know, the actual issue here is companies like McDonald's. McDonald's is the second largest private employer on the face of the earth. You know, they have the ability to change, fundamentally change the way businesses operate all around the globe. Right now, McDonald's is using its power to create a race to the bottom. They're the biggest purchasers of beef, of chicken, of tomatoes, of lettuce. They use their power to create a race to the bottom, and they say that these jobs are entry jobs for teenagers. In reality, these are careers for adults. You know, most of these fast food workers are 33 years old, 29 years old. Most of them are women, and a quarter of them have children. These are adults trying to deal with adult issues like paying rent and paying utilities, et cetera. Companies like McDonald's and Walmart and the American Airlines and United, all of these airlines, these top companies need to do the right thing. But you're starting to see companies like Facebook and Aetna and Nationwide Insurance and UPMC, University of Pennsylvania Medical Center, who went to 15 voluntarily. You're starting to see these things happen. But until you see companies like McDonald's start to lead the country in the right way, because the second that McDonald's goes to $15 in a union, other companies are going to follow behind them. They're the biggest. They're the baddest. They are the most sophisticated of the fast food chains. They're the second largest private employer. Other companies, if they see McDonald's steal wages, other companies think that it makes sense to steal wages. If they see McDonald's letting their employees be burned up and down their arms because grease is popping up, you know, I met a woman who the coffee pot had exploded on her because it got too hot, cut her chest all up. Like, when these type of things are happening and then the manager tells you to put mayonnaise or put mustard on your burn or on your cut and get back to work, you know, then that other companies think that it's all right to do that. So, and at the end of the day, you know, $1 billion is being spent to subsidize these fast food companies. So because McDonald's, Burger King, Wendy's, because they pay poverty wages, these workers are on food stamps, these workers are on public assistance, and taxpayers are footing the bill while McDonald's makes off with $5 billion in profit.
This has to change. And because of the activists on the front lines fighting for 15 and a union, things are changing. And the leading Democrats in the Congress, including people like Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Bernie Sanders, Patty Murray, Bobby Scott, and yes, me, are standing right beside these workers.
I think most people are aware that for the last 40 years, the middle class of our country has been in decline. That in Vermont and all over this country, we have people working two or three jobs. We have people working 50, 60, 70 hours a week just to put food on the table, just to make sure that their families can live with a modicum of dignity. And the reason for all of that is that wages in the United States of America are just too low.
This legislation will raise the minimum wage to $15 an hour by 2024. And I'm glad that we had 150 sponsors a few minutes ago. Now we're up to 152.
All right.
So it's growing. Our legislation provides important contrasts between the Democratic agenda for working families and the agenda promoted by President Trump and congressional Republicans. President Trump and the Republicans have used the 115th Congress and the beginning of the Trump administration to roll back safety and health protections for workers. They're attempting to take health care insurance away from 23 million Americans. They're undermining civil rights enforcement and promoting legislation that would deny workers their hard-earned overtime pay. This week's budget is a reflection of those priorities. But you can count on Democrats to continue to vigorously defend working families each and every day against these attacks. It's been too long since the last increase in the minimum wage, more than 10 years, and while 29 states have already taken action to raise their wages above the federal minimum, in 21 states, the minimum wage worker is still stuck at $7.25 an hour.
President Bush signed into law on May 25th, 2007, legislation increasing the minimum wage to $5.85 and then subsequently to $7.25. Since then, we've had an economic recession. We've had two presidents. Yet the one constant in the last 10 years have been the Republicans in Congress who are standing in the way of raising the minimum wage. Look, this president ran on a promise he'd stick up for the American worker. He tried to talk like a different type of Republican who might be willing to work with Democrats on issues that help working people like many of you here today. But since he's come into office, he has completely turned his back on the American worker.
Nearly two-thirds of those who make the minimum wage are women. And as with Brittany in her case, some of them are raising their families and making sacrifices so that there can be higher profits for corporate America. This is an ossifying of the Gilded Age, the exploitation of workers for the benefit of profits for the few at the expense of the many. Yes, I was speaker when we passed the minimum wage 10 years ago. Today, we were very proud of it. It was signed today, but we passed it in the first day that we came into office. Mr. Hoyer, our distinguished whip, is here. He knows that in the first 100 hours, we promised to the American people that if elected, we would raise the minimum wage, and we did. And we got to this point. We could only go this far with a Republican president, but we raised the minimum wage. And this day, after we passed the bill, we went out and had a rally on the lawn out here, and Senator Kennedy was so much a part of it, said as soon as we were finished, he said, you know what we have to do now? So what? He said, we have to raise the minimum wage. Because he knew right then and there that 7.25, which is the eventual increase, was not enough. I'm very honored to join the fight for 15. This is a living wage. Very important. We're proud of what we've done in California. I know that this distinguished Senator Murray is proud of Washington State, but we want that to happen in the whole country. It's important for families, for moms. Some moms have to have two jobs, and they have two jobs that deprives them the opportunity to mentor their children. So this is about, if we have family values, we must raise the minimum wage. If we care about the growth of our economy, just forgetting individuals, we can't, but if you just put it in terms of the economy will never grow to the extent that it must unless we put purchasing power into the hands of America's working families. So this increase in the minimum wage is the biggest stimulus that we can give to our economy. People will consume, they will inject demand into the economy, they will create jobs. This is it's good for the economy. It reduces the deficit. More importantly, most importantly, the impact it has in the lives of people so they can reach their aspirations, raise their families, and not live in a country that says, if you work hard, play by the rules, work full time, you live below the poverty line.
And we went all over the country with you together. And when you were out there in the beginning, Paco Fabian, What'd they say about $15 an hour? Ain't gonna happen. Now you got Pelosi and Schumer, you know, you got Sanders and Scott, you got the leadership of the Democratic caucus on both sides, both houses, hand in hand, together, saying we gotta have $15 an hour. And I just wanna say, hats off to the workers who led the way. Hats off to the business owners who believe in a high road business model, not a business model that says slam the workers, slam the ingredients on the food, slam everything down and then just jack up the profit high as you can and don't care about the consequences. You guys in the business community who believe that you can do well and do good at the same time, big thumbs up to you. We need you. We're partners.
But the fight isn't over. We need a vote. People like Brittany, who work hard every day, are going to keep on fighting, keep on using her voice, and keep on pushing and organizing until we win the fight for 15.
It's taught me to never give up. It's taught me that I do have a voice and I should not be afraid to use it. And it's taught me that there is so much we have in common as human beings across racial and socioeconomic lines, you know. When I first came out to the strike, I didn't know what to expect. But like I said, it was such a good feeling to see, you know, white people, Muslims, Blacks, Hispanics, Christians, people just from all different walks of life come coming out there fighting the same fight. Because like I said, you know, the fight for a living wage, the fight to put food on the table to support your family isn't just a Black issue or a poor issue. Like I said, it affects everybody from all corners of the, you know, of the U.S. So I'm glad to be able to fight this fight and to see others who can relate. I think it's a great thing, and I'm so proud and I'm so happy. And yes, I think all of you guys, all of the leaders of the Democratic Party and the CPC who are standing and fighting with us. And it just keeps motivating me more to keep pushing, because like I said, as we continue to grow and as we continue to get the word out, I think it will continue to move people to stand up and fight with us. And I'm so happy. And, you know, our movement reminds me a lot of the civil rights movement in terms of it started out with a group of folks and it grew, and people across the globe got wind of it and started thinking, hey, this is for a good cause. I can relate to it. We all deserve to be treated equally and like human beings. And like you said, slowly other leaders and other key people start joining in the fight, and then it helps us to move further and move farther along in our agenda. And I hope that it will continue to grow, and I hope that more politicians and more leaders and more philanthropists and more advocates will come out and continue to join us. Because like I said, this issue isn't one-sided, and it doesn't affect one group of people. It affects a bunch of different people.
Imagine you're a single parent, just trying to provide for your family on minimum wage. You put in 60 hours a week at two jobs, bringing home about $1,700 a month before taxes. You have to have enough money for rent, utilities, transportation, food for you and your family. You've got to pay for child care too. Since you work so much, somebody's got to look after the kid. Could you make that budget work for you and your family? What would happen if your child gets sick or your car breaks down? You know, it's just really impossible, and it doesn't have to be that way, not in the richest country in the world, at the richest point in its own history. And yet, every day, millions of Americans struggle hard to make it in this land of plenty. $7.25 an hour isn't gonna do it. $9 isn't gonna do it. Actually, $10.10 is not enough, and $12.50 is it going to cut it either? It actually leaves you below the poverty line, below the poverty line. And nobody in America who works full time should be living below the poverty line. Every single person in this country deserves a living wage, and that's $15 an hour, indexed to the median wage. After all, they can't afford to accept anything less. They don't deserve anything less. This episode of We the Podcast, this is Keith Ellison, and I will see you next time. Do us a favor, slide on over and rate, review, and subscribe to We the Podcast on iTunes. Tell a friend about We the Podcast, and make sure you listen every single week. This episode of We the Podcast was produced by Isaiah Kirshner-Breen, Abby Shanfield, Jamie Long, and Brett Morrow. We'll see you next time.